This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Like, wow, man, mention Valley Fever and you may have like totally gnarly visions of the 1980s and Tom Petty's song, Free Falling, that killer rad anthem to California's San Fernando Valley lifestyle. This, however, is a grody to the max disease that can, fatally affect people and animals in the southwest of, you know, the U.S. My righteous guest is veterinarian Dr. Christine Bukowitz. Of course, you know, this will be the last time I'm going to do my Valley speak for you, so get over it now. It's like, whatever. We'll be right back after this short break.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your Cat Tree Tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Christine Bukowitz, thank you so much for being with me today. And I apologize for the Valley Fever imitation. I know it was bad.
It brought back some memories. Thank you for having me.
Well, number one, since Valley Fever has nothing to do with San Fernando Valley, what is Valley Fever?
Valley fever is a disease caused by a fungus that lives in the soil. And like you said, it tends to be in the desert areas of the southwestern United States. So we see a lot of it in Arizona and the San Joaquin Valley in California. And there's some areas of New Mexico and Texas and Utah that we'll see some cases as well. The fungus likes to grow in the soil, especially when it's rainy. And then in this area, it gets hot and dries out. And the wind kicks up. So anything that can disturb the soil, like construction or a dog digging a hole or just the wind itself, can start blowing the fungus around. And when people or animals inhale the fungus, that's how they get infected and get Valley Fever.
So it's out there. It's ubiquitous. And that's scary because I live in Southern California. It is, has to be around me, but thankfully it's a disease I don't hear a lot about, and I've been practicing veterinary medicine for now over 20 years, and honestly, I've only seen one case, and it had a lot of us just really scratching our heads in Southern California. Let me give you the scenario and see if this sounds like something that you're typically seeing. So it's a dog that was born in San Diego. It had not traveled out of the area other than twice to go up to the San Joaquin Valley area that you mentioned. And it presented in a really kind of a strange way. It had kind of a lameness, and this was a young dog at the time. It was about a year of age. It came in and it had a lameness in a left rear leg. So I took an x-ray, and the x-ray, I thought, oh my goodness. This dog has cancer, because it was very unusual. It was a young dog and it had this almost moth-eaten appearance to the femur, that leg bone, the upper leg bone. I thought, wow, I've never seen a dog this young with cancer. I know it can happen. So I sent the films out to be reviewed by a board-certified veterinary radiologist. He came back as reading it going, wow, really bizarre, but this could be cancer. Long and short of it is, send it over to a board certified oncologist. That was it, a cancer doctor thinking of this is cancer. That's where it needs to go. The long and short, after they looked at it, not really sure, they took an aspirate of the area and had a diagnosis of valley fever. Is that an outlier type of case or something that you've heard of in the past?
That is not at all an outlier here.
Oh,
and
wow.
that overlap between what looks like maybe cancer and what is actually valley fever is very common in those bone cases. So we see that pretty frequently. And I grew up in the Midwest, went to vet school on the East Coast, and moved to Tucson 17 years ago. And I had to learn all about valley fever as soon as I got here. And I learned it quickly because we see a lot of it.
So Arizona, would you say that's somewhat the hotbed for this disease?
It is, yeah.
So what other symptoms? So here was that bizarre symptom, and it was Stanley, and Stanley having what we thought was bone cancer. And thankfully, after a year of being on some pretty pricey medication, I was asking the owner, well, we can get into that later about what it typically costs, but thankfully they had pet insurance. So another reason for people to have pet insurance when diseases like this come up. So what are some of the other symptoms that you see, Dr. Christine?
Well, like we discussed earlier, so it starts as a respiratory infection. So a dog may come in and be coughing, have a fever, be tired, not eating well, losing some weight. Really pretty nonspecific signs. For a lot of dogs, that can be so mild that the owner doesn't need to bring them in. They seem to recover, seem like a little sick and then got better. But if the fungus spreads outside the lungs, like what you saw, we call that disseminated, it can go to pretty much anywhere. And the signs at that point, the symptoms become, they reflect where the fungus has settled. And dogs' bones are the most common location, and that's usually a leg bone, so an owner will come in with a limping dog. Sometimes there's a swelling over a bony area. I've seen infections on the ribs and the skull. It can be in the skin, and you can get swellings underneath the skin, maybe with some draining fluid, and it can spread to the brain as well. And then owners will usually come in because their dog is having seizures all of a sudden.
That is just a horrid disease. But here you've been in Arizona now for 17 years, and all the people that live in Arizona, dogs, cats, and you can talk about what other species get it. But it doesn't seem like everyone who inhales it, because like we all need to, and if you're there, it seems like you must have inhaled some of these spores at some point in time. Is there any research as to why some animals, some people are more susceptible than others?
I would love to know that. We don't know that yet.
The million-dollar question.
It's something we're trying to look at. We're trying to figure out why some dogs get so sick and some dogs either don't get sick or they just get a very mild illness. It's something we really want to understand because it will help us, especially with treatment, to know how long we're going to need to treat a dog. The dog's going to respond well or dog may need medication for the rest of its life.
Do you find that some dogs are more sensitive than others? Is it like middle-aged dogs that are more prone or males or females, anything like that?
That's a good question. We definitely have a lot of information about that in people, but it's not as clear in dogs. So there's some older studies that show that boxers seem to get really sick. Other than that, you can't really pinpoint any one breed or any one age. We tend to think of kind of the young adult, 2 to 4, maybe even up to 6 years of age. But I've definitely seen it in older dogs as well. Just kind of depends. There's some research that found that dogs that have more area to roam in, like an acre that they can just run around in, are more prone to getting infected. Dogs that are walked on sidewalks are less likely to get infected, but you know that has to do with exposure most likely. So you think about working dogs and terriers liking to dig a nice big hole. Those may be the dogs that we worry about more, but no absolute rules. Any dog is at risk.
I mean, it's devastating to think of you're just doing nothing and you're getting exposed to these things. You'd mentioned that we keep talking about dogs. What other species can get this? So people can get it.
People can get it, and it's been seen in almost everything that breathes air. The only exception to that is birds.
Huh.
But it's even been seen in marine mammals. So
there's not a lot of marine mammals there in Arizona.
Not here, off the coast of California.
Okay.
But it is important to remember, not all animals get affected the same way. So they see the fungus in livestock animals after they've died, but they never really got sick with it. And alpacas and llamas get very sick and they die, and the fungus, you open them up and the fungus is everywhere. Cats don't seem to get infected as frequently as dogs, but when they do, they're usually sick. And primates get really sick as well. That's a concern for zoos that are in the endemic area. But dogs, we really consider our most clinically relevant species, first because they get infected at about the same rates that people do, and second because they're our companions. We love them.
I know we're talking about pets and you're a veterinarian, but you also work. Tell us about where you're working. That's very fascinating.
I work at the Valley Fever Center for Excellence, which is at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And we do all kinds of research on different aspects of the disease. And obviously, my interest is more in the animals, but there's certainly work being done in people as well. One of the things we're trying to look at now is to learn more about the immunology of the disease in dogs. Again, so we can try to predict which dogs will not respond well, will need more medication. That would be great to know. It would really make our lives practicing veterinary medicine a lot easier. Of course, our big project is to develop a vaccine to prevent infections in dogs. And if that is safe and effective, they will go on to get that vaccine available for people.
And this is one of the reasons I so love being a veterinarian, is this translational medicine. So you're not causing disease in dogs or sea otters, marine mammals, etc. It's just naturally happening. And then you can use studying on them and trying to help them to also help people. That's just such a win-win situation.
Exactly. It is. Yeah. Great work.
Congratulations, and thank you for doing that. You had mentioned that dogs can sometimes get these oozing lesions, and I'm sure people are thinking, oh my goodness, you know, if my dog were to have Valley Fever, does that increase my chance of exposure to that pet of getting Valley Fever? Does that happen?
That it does not. Valley Fever is not contagious. So if you get Valley Fever and your dog gets Valley Fever, it's because you're breathing the same air, not because you caught it from your dog. So they can get oozing lesions. A cat can as well. We see that quite a bit. But the fungus has two different stages to its life cycle. It's kind of cool, actually. So there's a stage that lives in the soil, and that's what you breathe in and catch. And then it changes. It transforms once it's in the body, and you can't catch that part. So what is coming oozing out isn't something that you can get. Obviously, you don't want to, you know, cover that up and give it a chance to transform back to the soil form. But really, that's not a big risk.
Well, I'm chatting right now with Dr. Christine Bukovic. She is a veterinarian doing research at the Valley Fever Center for Excellence in Arizona. We're going to be right back after this short break, and we're going to talk about how can you diagnose this disease and treat it. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
You think that you're rescuing them, but honestly, they're going to end up rescuing you. You don't know what they've gone through, and they're not going to be perfect. And they are so happy that you are taking a chance on them to be a part of your family. I urge you to go down to your local shelters, pounds, dog rescues, foundations, you name it, and rescue a dog. Once you get your rescue dog, you should definitely order some DinoVite. Go online and order it. DinoVite.com. DinoVite. It's awesome stuff. 90 days of DinoVite will make your dog a happy dog. It will help them with their overall health. You don't need to spend thousands on vet bills. DinoVite is the best thing that's ever happened to my dogs, you know, besides me, of course. Call 859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DinoVite.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Christine, this is a scary disease because You're just out there minding your own business and you can get exposure. And the signs, as I saw with Stanley, was lameness. You're seeing respiratory issues or oozing lesions going, wow, what is this? How is this diagnosed typically? Because I know we had to go through a very circuitous roundabout, Ray, to come up with a diagnosis for Stanley.
Right. And that's why travel history is so important. That's a really good example. And worry about these dogs that are traveling through this area or living part of the year, and then they say go back to Illinois. That's where I'm originally from. The signs of valley fever are so nonspecific that a veterinarian in Illinois is not going to think of valley fever first thing unless they know the dog's been in this area. So that travel history is really important, along with a good physical exam. We also will routinely do some blood work. We look for increased white cell counts. It tells us that there's some sort of infection. There's changes on the x-rays we look for, so you saw the bony changes. There's also some indications in the lungs on x-ray that we look for that are typical. Don't always see them, but there are some that are more common. There is a blood test for valley fever. It checks for the dog's immune response to the fungus. So that can be negative, especially early in the disease. The dog just may not have a really good immune response yet. So you can need to do some follow-up. It's definitely the whole picture, though. There's not one test that can say, this is, you know, do this and you will absolutely get the diagnosis. You got to think about everything.
And that is one of the hardest things in veterinary medicine, because you love your pet, but sometimes there are financial constraints that you have. And I know it's so frustrating for the pet parent as well as the veterinarian going, okay, well, ooh, I think that, you know, we need to take an x-ray for Stanley because Stanley is limping. All right. You take that x-ray and it's like, oh, well, what caused it? You know, it looks like cancer. Well, then what do you do for that? Well, we need to diagnose it for sure. And it can get rather pricey to do these diagnostics to come up with an answer. Now, you mentioned titers can be done. Is that just more of a follow-up? Because you said in the early stages, you may not see a positive titer.
We use the titers to both identify cases, to help us identify cases, and also to follow up. Again, you know, the titer it's just not the only test I rely on. We use it sort of in conjunction with everything else. I'm a little less worried about a dog with maybe a low positive titer who is feeling great. So that test can still be positive for a time afterwards. So again, you really have to look at how the dog is doing overall.
So now you've come up with a diagnosis of my dog, my cat has valley fever. What do you do for it? I know for Stanley, he's been on an antifungal medication. And I called before doing the show saying, all right, what did it cost to come up with a diagnosis and so far treating Stanley for a year? And thankfully, Stanley is doing marvelously. The lameness is gone. The x-rays are improving. He feels like a champ. He's been always a total squirrel of a dog, but sometimes a little less squirrely. But so far for a year's time, it has cost about $6,000. So what is the usual treatment that you... Is that a low price?
we do the same things that they use, that they have for humans. So we try to stick with the oral antifungals. The dog can stay at home then. So fluconazole and itraconazole are the most commonly used. And just a quick survey of veterinarians in this area, fluconazole is by far the most commonly prescribed medication, antifungal medication. Treatment, though, is long-term, and that can be really frustrating. A lot of times the dog's feeling better, but if you recheck x-rays or the blood work, you know the fungus isn't totally cleared out yet. So for dogs with respiratory disease, we think, you know, about 3 to 6 months of treatment. For dogs where the fungus has spread somewhere else, you know, 6 to 12 months, you know, a year plus sounds about right for that. Some dogs will need several years of medications. Some dogs, every time you take them off the medication, they just get sick again. So it's hard to predict. There's some basic trends that we follow, but you can't predict how an individual dog is going to do. And I'm happy to hear that Stanley's feeling better. The medication is pricey, though. So for fluconazole in this area, it's, you know, for a small dog, maybe $30 a month. For a large dog, you can be looking at a couple hundred. And that's, it's frustrating and it's a problem.
And then you have the follow-up blood tests and x-rays, all those things that you need to do to monitor. Are there side effects to these antifungals?
There are. It's not terribly common. And, you know, out here, we're using fluconazole all the time. And I've only seen a handful of side effects, but they can happen. Both the medications can affect the liver, so that's something else, unfortunately, you need to monitor. You need to make sure the dog's liver is tolerating the medication. Itraconazole can cause some skin reactions, and if that's the case, then they can't take it anymore. Some owners report some changes in the fur. Those, you know, I'm willing to overlook because I want the dog feeling better. That's my primary thing. There is also an injectable medication we use, but we save that for the really severe cases, because it has to be given in the hospital and it can be very hard on the kidneys. But that's really only for the dogs that aren't doing well on oral medication.
Now, again, I know you're a veterinarian, but since you're working at the Valley Center, what happens with people? Same type of treatment, same type of monitoring, same kind of side effects?
I probably can't speak all that much about the exact clinical outlook for people, but the treatments are the same. A lot of the testing is the same. We borrow for dogs what they've already developed for use in people. From reading papers, it seems like people tend to get more tests done, probably a little more follow-up, and that's just a matter of people having insurance and not having to pay for this out of pocket. But yeah, I think we're probably more aggressive with treating dogs than they are with people. People really don't like when their dogs aren't feeling well. So our goal is to get them. I don't want to just tell an owner, take your dog home and let it sleep for a month. People want their dogs feeling better.
They're part of the family. Prognosis. So, okay, here we have Stanley, who's a year out, feeling good, still on medication. Titers have definitely improved. I keep getting updates from our internist because now he's being taken care of an internist. And again, these owners were so fortunate because when they first got Stanley, they got pet insurance, and they said pet insurance has been just a major boon because it's helped so much pain for the majority of all of these tests and treatment. What is the prognosis in general?
In general, overall, I'd say it's pretty good. I like the respiratory cases that, you know, resolve after a couple months and seem to feel great. And those are dogs that I feel confident are going to go on and do pretty well. We still monitor them, especially in the first year. That's when you're most worried about the fungus becoming active again. For the cases where it's spread somewhere else, I would say most dogs at this point are still doing very well. I worry about cases where it's spread to the brain, and those are owners I won't promise that they'll ever get off the medication. It may just be safest for the dog to stay on the medication. But like I said, I think the biggest factor is once the dog stops the medication, there's a lot of monitoring in that first month or two, and you want to see how they do. So we watch them pretty carefully.
Well, diagnosing, treatment, prognosis, all of this is marvelous, but to not ever get that disease in the first place in areas that are endemic, that are so prone to it, like Arizona, New Mexico, you said California. You, working at the Valley Fever Center for Excellence, are working on a vaccine. Tell us about that, because that seems to hold so much promise.
Exactly, because there's no way to prevent it. The risk factor is breathing, so we're kind of stuck.
Stuck, yeah.
And with people, you know, they can wear masks, they can hose down the dirt, and dogs don't like wearing masks, and they don't hose down the dirt before they dig a hole in your yard. So the vaccine is really going to be the way to try to prevent it, and it's a modified version of the fungus. A gene has been removed. That gene seems to affect the virulence of the fungus. So you can give it, get an immune reaction without the animal becoming ill. So we're very hopeful for it.
Now, this isn't the first time a vaccine has been tried. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what makes your vaccine different and better?
The earlier vaccines, there is probably in the 1950s, well before my time in this area, they tried giving spirules of the vaccine to dogs. But they formed giant, it was protective, but they formed giant abscesses at the site.
Not good.
That was not good. That was a problem. And then they tried it in people and saw the same kind of thing too. It's not a side effect you're going to tolerate. And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, they developed a recombinant vaccine, which was protective. Unfortunately, it was incredibly expensive to make. And with this being such a localized disease, it just wasn't cost effective. So the good thing about our vaccine is that it's cheap to make. You can grow it. So
cheap is always good whenever you're talking about research.
Exactly right.
So here's disease that I guess in the veterinary and human lingo would be considered an orphan disease because there aren't that many people that are being affected. As I understand, it's about 30,000 people and about 60,000 dogs per year in Arizona get affected. Does that sound about right?
Probably. We don't have good numbers on the dogs. The disease is reportable on humans in Arizona and California. So you can get really good numbers, but it's not reportable in dogs. So, you know, we have some early work out of, the 2000s, but we just don't know for sure how many dogs are getting it.
Well, this vaccine, the work that you're doing sounds so marvelous because this disease can be so devastating. Sounds like the fatality rate is fairly low, which is good, but the side effects of your pet just not feeling good, you not feeling good, having lesions that a veterinarian may think is cancer or seizures, all the rest of it is just, thank you, Dr. Christine, for what you're doing. That is great work. When do you think this might be coming to market?
We are hoping for about 4 to 5 years for dogs.
And then for people, who knows?
I don't know. The regulation for a vaccine in people is very different from what we have in dogs. So one step at a time.
One step at a time. And I like those one baby paw steps at a time. Anything else that you need to tell us about Valley Fever, the work that you're doing, the Center for Excellence?
I think you will provide the links to our website. I think we have a lot of good information there, both for people and for dogs. So if you want to learn something more, that's a great place to look.
I've had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Christine Bukovich. She is one of the veterinarians at Valley Fever Center for Excellence in Arizona. Thank you so much. I know I've learned a lot. And next time I see a pet, I'll always make sure to ask that question. So where have you been traveling? So what pet owners are listening right now, if your pet comes up with some kind of condition you're just not always too sure about, your veterinarian scratching their head, make sure you tell them where your pet's been traveling, because we take our pets with us so frequently. You never know, you may be living in Wisconsin, but you visited Arizona or California, New Mexico, your pet could be affected with something like Valley Fever. So thank you very much for listening. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Please tune in again next week. We'll give you more information on how to make you, the best possible pet owner. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.